From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Do the cost of playing sports hold your child back?
As a child, I often say that I was snubbed out by poverty. And I'm just trying to make sure that I make it a priority to add extracurricular activities to my daughter's life without overcompensating, overspending, breaking the bank, or pushing her too far.
That's Tavari Brown from Atlanta. Ahead this hour, we talk with NBA legend Dikembe Mutombo about how he is trying to make youth leagues more affordable. And yeah, I may bring up his plans to buy a big league NBA team, the Houston Rockets. That's all coming up. But first, we always want to know what you think. Have you ever had to tell your child that they can't play a sport because of the cost? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the program. So last week, there was a major shakeup in police operations in Savannah. The city council voted to end the merger with Savannah Chatham Police, reportedly due to costs. The change is set to kick in February 1st. Savannah is not the only community looking at a major policing change. Up in the northwest corner of the state, the small town of Varnell is wrestling with policing issues. This month, the city council voted to eliminate the town's police department altogether. The mayor vetoed that move. The city council could override the veto tonight, but it's expected instead to let voters decide the matter during the November election. Reporter Chris Whitfield has been covering this story for the Daily Citizen in Dalton, and he joins me on the line. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you on the program. You know, I want to start here on a percentage basis, right? How much of this story you've been covering is about personalities, right? Maybe a rift between the chief of police in Varnell and members of the city council. And how much of this is about the cost, the actual cost of providing the best policing possible to the people of Varnell?
Well, I think anytime you deal with small town political issues, big personalities become a big part of it. And I think that's what you've got here as well. But as far as cost, you know, one of the council members has always railed and been a true fiscal conservative. And one of his big sayings is getting the most bang for your buck when it comes to taxes. And that's one of the things that he has hammered away on when it comes to eliminating the Varnell Police Department, is that taxpayers are already paying for the sheriff's department up here. And it would be prohibitive as far as cost concerned in his eyes to go ahead and just get rid of a small town police force that he feels isn't needed, that there's already plenty of protection up here through Whitfield County.
So this is Council Member Pourquoi that you're referring to here?
Yeah, Jan Pourquoi.
Okay.
He's originally from Belgium and is a naturalized citizen and works up here and has a wife from here. He has always been a very firm believer in fiscal conservatism, and you know, the people who elected him had to know that this was on his agenda because he's always talked about this.
Okay, so let's do this. Let's listen to Council Member Pourquoi. And again, as Chris just mentioned, he proposed dissolving the Varnell Police Department earlier this month. Here he is talking to television station WTVC.
We need to create the maximum bang for the buck for the taxpayer in Varnell. The way to do that is eliminate duplications we are now having in terms of law enforcement.
Okay, and I want to keep rolling here because I want to hear more of the various sides on this. I want to listen to Varnell City Council Member Andrea Gordy, right? She also voted to dismantle the police department. Here she is explaining her vote.
If I can save my community hundreds of thousands of dollars every year, that's what I'm elected to do, is to be a good steward of their money and protect their well-being. So we're kind of looking at it from both angles. And this really is going to boil down to consolidation. If the sheriff's office can do it, there's no reason to make the taxpayers pay twice. They shouldn't pay for a city cop and a county cop.
Okay, so Chris, help me boil this down here. It seems to me there are redundancies, right? There's no way around that. So here's my question. Varnell has a population of 1,800. My understanding is that that's roughly 1% of Whitfield County. So why does Varnell, a town that small, even have a police department? Has there been much debate around that question?
Well, one of the things that's in the state constitution, in order to have a city government to begin with, you have to provide certain services. trash pickup, recreation services, or police protection. So in a lot of these incorporated towns, the city of Eaton over in Murray County has a much smaller population, and they have a police force. The city of Cahutta and Tunnel Hill in Whitfield County both have very relatively small populations, and they have their own city police forces. So in order to be incorporated as a city, you have to provide some sort of public safety, whether it's through a contract with the county or whether it's providing your own. So that's why these municipalities have a police force to begin with.
Okay, gotcha. I want to hear from more on this, because this is really a rip-roaring debate that's going on in Varnell right now. This is a former Varnell City Council member, Brent Newsom. And these are comments to WDEF-TV, and he's suggesting here that getting rid of the police department is a real mistake.
It was evident that the council did not act in accordance with what the people want. I think I was as angry as everybody else in the city. I used to serve on the council 4 years ago, so I'm very well connected with what's going on. And to know that this council had the audacity to take it upon themselves and think they could do away with our police force is absurd.
Hmm. If you're just joining us, Chris Whitfield is our guest. He's a reporter with the Daily Citizen in Dalton. So, Chris, I guess that's an important question here. How much public input went into this decision?
Well, none. And I think that is the main thing that most people have gotten upset about in this issue. The way that it was done, a lawsuit was filed on Friday against the three members of the council who voted against it, saying that they violated the Open Meetings Act, which, you know, there were a lot of procedural problems with this vote. There was no agenda posted at City Hall as the Open Meetings Act requires. There was no agenda provided. And Mr. Pourquoi's motion was not on the agenda either. So there was no community input into this. The spark of all this was the arrest of a city councilman.
Mm-hmm.
And the handling of that arrest by the police chief. The city council was not happy that the councilman was not arrested immediately. They didn't find out about it until 9 days later. So, you know, you started off with a clash of personalities, and,
yes.
And there was the biggest one. When Police Chief Lyle Grant was called to a city councilman's house, he even wrote into the report that he was tolerant of his behavior because of his position with the city council. So that sort of preferential treatment was what started this whole deal. And then the city council suspended Chief Grant, and then the city councilman, Sheldon Fowler, resigned from his post. And then when Mayor Anthony Holsey reinstated Chief Grant, that was all that was supposed to have happened at the meeting there. But as soon as Mayor Holsey reinstated Grant to his position, Councilmember Pourquoi made his motion and had his three votes, and they went ahead and did it.
You know, I want to hear from a resident, right? The meeting that you're describing here, there wasn't a whole lot of public debate, discussion. It wasn't a very well-attended meeting. But one of the people who did show up was Varnell resident Bill Morgan, and he says he's just sort of mystified by the whole idea of getting rid of the police department.
I don't know how you can change money to help somebody else and take away from the protection of the citizens. That, to me, should be the number one rule, is to protect the people that live within your city.
Okay, so, Chris, if we move this forward just a bit, is there any question over whether the Whitfield County Sheriff's Department can cover Varnell?
I don't think there is. I mean, if the people of Whitfield, I mean, if you say that, then you're calling into question the ability of Whitfield County Sheriff's Office, and I don't think anybody here is actually calling that into effect. And to be clear, Bill Morgan is a former city manager of Varnell, and he is the one who has filed the lawsuit against the three members of the city council.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there are several municipalities around here. The city of Resaca and Gordon County disbanded their police force and entered into an intergovernmental agreement with Gordon County to provide a dedicated Gordon County Sheriff's Officer to always be on patrol in the city of Resaca. And that basically is what Jan Pourquoi and the other members of the council would like to enter into with Whitfield County.
Yeah.
You're looking at a budget of $300,000 for the Varnell Police Department with five full-time people and five part-time people, whereas they feel like you can get that same coverage by entering into a contract with Whitfield County for somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 a year to provide dedicated service. Mm-hmm. And they feel like there's not going to be any drop-off. Now, of course, the citizens, you know, they like their police officers. They like their police force. And, you know, if it makes them feel safe, then that's what they're expressing to the council at this point.
On that question of whether the county sheriff's department can cover Varnell, here's that question essentially put to the county sheriff, Scott Chitwood, and here's his response to WTVC-TV.
We answer all the major calls in Varnell right now. So, again, yeah, we don't anticipate a major workload addition whatsoever.
So let me widen this out just a bit here with you, Chris. President Obama's task force, right, on 21st century policing made the point that half of all police departments are made up of fewer than 10 officers. That's, you're around 10, right? At
right.
Varnell, full-time and part-time. Nearly three-quarters of agencies have fewer than 25 officers. And the idea is that, that these small forces often lack the resources for training and equipment. Was that the case in Varnell? I guess a better way of asking this is the Varnell Police Department an accredited, professional, certified police department?
They have not gone through their entire certification. Most of these guys are guys who work for the police department and also have other jobs in Varnell. So, I mean, you know, what Sheriff Chitwood said was correct. There's no major investigation that goes on in Varnell that isn't already handled by the Whitfield County Sheriff's Office. There's not a major investigative unit with the Varnell Police Department. 95% of the magistrate court issues that the city of Varnell Police Department deals with are traffic offenses.
Yeah, and those are about essentially traffic violations, which come with fines, and there's no doubt history tells us that part of the function of, you know, local police departments is to collect fines, and fines help fill the city coffers, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. What do you expect will happen at the meeting tonight?
I think at the meeting tonight you'll see a lot of venting, a lot of people getting some things off their chest. I think you'll see probably about 2 hours of public comments with very little speaking by the city council.
Wow.
And then I think they'll make the motion that Mayor Pro Tem David Owens has already said that he will make to put it on a November ballot and let the voters decide at that point. I don't think at this point that the Varnell Police Department is in danger of being disbanded again. I don't think they're going to go to the tactic of overriding the mayor's veto of their action. I think they'll put it before the voters in November, and they've said that they'll abide by that as sort of a straw poll to figure out what the community wants to do.
Chris, appreciate it. Chris Whitfield, he's a reporter with the Daily Citizen in Dalton. Chris, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And just ahead, we add two more songs to our Essential Georgia playlist. But first, former Atlanta Hawk Dikembe Mutombo on paving the way for future athletes. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. Dikembe Mutombo is one of the most recognizable players for the Atlanta Hawks, now retired. Yeah, from playing, but not retired as a person, that's for sure. The 7'2" center spent 5 years in Atlanta and was a defensive powerhouse in the NBA for 13 more seasons. He was famous for his signature "not in my house" move. Right as he blocked shots, and then he wagged that finger. These days, Dikembe has his sights set on owning a team. This month, he revealed he's looking for partners to buy the Houston Rockets. Oh, yeah, we're going to cover it all. Dikembe, welcome. Why are you laughing?
No, we're here to talk about something else.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. And that something else is very important, doggone it, because I made a couple of calls last night just to be reminded of how much it cost over the years to put my daughter through youth sports, and I nearly fell out of my chair. But, Dikembe, what are you thinking here? 5 years with the Hawks,
yes.
Final 5 years of your 18-year career with the Rockets. You still have a home there, right? In Houston? You retired in Hall of Famer. Come on, Hall of Famer. And now you want to be an NBA owner? Why on earth? Have you watched this offseason, the madness of this offseason? Why on earth would you want to put yourself through that mind melt?
You know what? First, I want to say thank you for having me
on
this show.
Of course.
It's a great pleasure to see you again, my
brother.
Yeah,
man.
Everyone you have a dream. Everyone you have his own bucket list. I've accomplished a lot in my life. I'm still trying to pursue so many dreams, from a philanthropic work to businesses. I'm investing in a lot of businesses. And working for the NBA for the last 8 years.
As an ambassador.
Yeah, as a global ambassador, have taught me a lot. And it's been a few times in the last 4.5 years. I did have an interest in being part of something. You know, first, we did have a group to pursue the Atlanta Hawks.
You wanted to buy the Hawks.
Yes, we did have a group. It was very successful, but we didn't get far.
Right.
And we begged for the Hawks twice. Before the last guy got in and before the new group came in.
Yes.
So I learned the mechanism of what it takes to go for. So now what I'm doing, through my world, I've met so many wonderful people in my life, and I want to encourage them and bring them together on the table so if they can be interested about eating this piece of cake, you know. It's not like Dikembe Mutombo putting $1 billion there. I don't have it.
Dikembe, you just said it. You're going to need somewhere just south of $2 billion in order to make this dream
a
reality.
I know a lot of people who have more than that.
Yes, you do. But we've had this conversation. It is not easy to convince people to part with their cash. How are you going to be able to put this together? You certainly know how difficult a task it's going to be.
I'm working. You're not going to believe how many phone calls I'm getting every day.
Really?
Yeah. Last night I was up until 1 o'clock in the morning talking to folks calling me. It's not like me calling. Since this thing went to the news, I don't know how people got access to my cell phone, but people are calling me, people I've met before in my life. We never know. It's good to have dream.
Yes.
It is good to dream. You know, they said that your worth is about your network. Mm-hmm. It's about how many people do you know in your life, how successful can you be.
Right.
In any venture, you're never going to be successful unless you know people that you can bring together to succeed.
So we played a clip at the top of the show that has me reflecting on, you know, another part of a conversation we had recently about giving back and
yes.
your humanitarian work. And I just love hearing you talk about why you give back and why you think more athletes should.
I think it's a moral duty in a society that when you succeed, you have to make sure that those who are left behind you are succeed as well. Because you don't want to live in a community that is falling apart and you be the only one who's successful. And you have to try to see if there's all the problems that facing the community that you can tackle. And that's the reason why I want to give back. And I feel that God bless us in a different way and give us an opportunity to bless all the people. And I've demonstrated that by building a $30 million hospital with my wife. And I want to do more for the youth. Especially in the city of Atlanta.
Can we talk about that? Can we talk about, and can we bring someone else into the conversation here? Look, if you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Atlanta Hawks player Dikembe Mutombo. We also want to bring in Haley Hill. She is the branch director For the Tybee Island YMCA, which is a branch of the YMCA of Coastal Georgia.
Yes.
Haley, good to have you on the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, look, Dikembe mentioned it just a moment ago. He wants to give back. He wants to encourage young people, and he wants to tackle problems. Look, there is a problem with the cost of youth sports in this country. Haley, to what extent is it on your radar?
Well, first, I'd like to thank everyone for having me here. And Dikembe, I'd like to thank you for taking the opportunity to give back to the community. You said it really well
thank
with
you.
Everybody coming together to strengthen the community and be a part of something greater, which is youth sports and the conversation that we're having. From our perspective where we are in Savannah, poverty is so rampant that, like you said earlier, that it's not easy to get people to part with their cash, especially now with there not being a lot of cash to depart with. Mm. So the cost of a $1,200 a year sports team when everything else is in priority, the difference really comes down, you know, there's so many disparities that here's another one that we're seeing show up in sports participation and the access to high quality sports leagues.
So Haley, can I stop you for a second there? You just made
sure.
me think of this. I mean, we're talking about Dikembe putting together a group. Thank goodness he gives back to the community the way he does. But we're talking about him putting together a group to buy a NBA team at a price tag of somewhere around close to $2 billion. What would it take? Clearly a fraction of that. Talk about priorities. To better fund youth sports across the country. Do you think about that when you hear a number like that to buy an NBA franchise?
Completely, especially in the nonprofit world where we are working to solve so many different social problems. The financial assistance that we set up just to have people come into a rec league, and then to hear a $2 billion price tag on something where there's so many youth that have aspirations of going into professional sports, and then the team costs $2 billion. How do you even grasp that in reality of paying for college, much less, wow, that's an expensive team.
Okay, so I want to play some clips. I want people who listen to this program to weigh in. Yesterday we asked folks, have you ever had to tell your child that they can't play a sport because it just costs too much doggone money? Here's one response.
Tavari Brown, and I'm calling from Atlanta. As a child, I often say that I was snubbed out by poverty. I wasn't able to do a lot of things because my mother couldn't afford to enroll me in activities or pay for uniforms or support me in extracurricular activities. And I'm just trying to make sure that I make it a priority to add extracurricular activities to my daughter's life without overcompensating, overspending, breaking the bank, or pushing her too far.
So, Dikembe, I know you used to coach an AAU team.
I'm still coaching.
You're still coaching?
Yes.
So now you deal with parents. You're on the front lines of this.
Yes.
You know what the costs are here, and you know
Definitely.
What the costs are for these parents. I mean, what do you say? How do you manage this? And you want kids to play because you know what it gives them. But what's to be done about the cost of this?
I think a lot got to do with putting the team together, traveling.
My goodness, we're not even talking about traveling yet. I mean, come on.
The food during the game, because especially on the weekend when you have three games a week on Saturday and your first game is at 8 o'clock, your child got to eat breakfast, you got to eat lunch before the second game, and got to eat dinner before the late game.
Yes.
We're talking about maybe spending another $200 every day.
Right, right.
I think we are trying to come up with a solution. That was Flipgift, the company that I believe in, the company that I invest in, the company that I'm becoming part of as an ambassador. We want to do for so many parents and so many kids who are struggling over there to raise money.
So, Haley, I literally had a conversation with my lovely ex-wife, the mother of my kids, last night about the cost, because I needed to be reminded for this segment of the cost of having our daughter play AAU basketball over the years. And Haley, I nearly fell out of my chair.
Absolutely. I mean, it is pretty expensive. And now the leagues are starting where they're starting in elementary school on the competitive travel leagues. Yes. You're starting those costs in the second and third grade just so that your child remains competitive moving into high school and then beyond if that's the option. But imagine a $1,200 to $1,700 a year starting in the second grade just to play baseball or soccer. I mean, it adds up very quickly, and this is just in the, you know, the elementary, middle school age groups.
Okay, so we asked more folks to talk to us about these costs, and here's another response.
This is James Pitts, like in Pittsburgh. I'm calling from Marietta, Georgia, and I am a volunteer soccer coach with a select team of U17 boys, and we struggle every year with the high cost of soccer, which is like $2,000 per year to play.
I know I'm going to sound like I'm whining this whole segment, and I apologize for that.
No,
I
apologize. You're telling the truth.
It's real. You know,
the thing is, we want to give our parents and coaches a great access to raise money faster. So FlipGive is allowing the parents and the coaches to create their own team by going to the flipgive.com where they can shop online instead of going to the store.
So what is this, the flip? What are you saying here?
FlipGive.
Okay.
So you go to the flipgive.com and you create your own team.
Yeah.
And you shop online. So you can shop in any from Amazon all the way down. And then FlipGive will give you almost all of that. By you shopping, you will get close to.
Is there a business for refurbishing equipment, right? For taking used or lightly used equipment and refurbishing it and putting that, making that available to parents so they don't have to pay $300 for a composite baseball bat, softball bat.
You cannot refurbish tennis shoes for a basketball. You cannot refurbish a ball because when you finish playing with the basketball, that ball is dead. You have to throw them away. So you just need a new stuff.
I'm trying to figure it out, man. Just to help me here because this is crazy. So, all right, here's the other thing. The cost on this is so high. Is there any, Dikembe, I'm coming to you on this.
Yes.
Is there profiteering going on here? I'm just trying to figure it out. So many parents see youth sports as this golden scholarship ticket for their child, right?
I don't know.
Is there profiteering going on here? Is it just?
I think we are trying to keep our kids busy. You know, you look at the increasing of the kids using drugs today in our community. By getting our kids engaged in the sport, allowing us to feel peace of mind with our children, that's very important. I think that we don't want our kids to join the gang, to be in trouble, to be in the mall all day. And by putting them in some sport activities, making our kids to be free, to participate, to learn about some leadership skill, and learn about respect and teamwork. And I think that's very important for us to have our kids doing something.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The problem still, the cost.
Yes.
The cost that what is killing so many parents who don't have that mean.
Can we talk about cost a little bit more? I know I'm whipping this thing. This is Lanice White. She's a single mother. She's working full time. She lives in Baltimore. She makes about $30,000 a year. And she told NPR that to pay for her son to play football, she's had to make some tough choices.
If you have to buy pads or pants, or if you have to buy shoulder pads, that might be another $100 to $150. I have not bought things for myself for lunch before to make sure that my son could have the things that he needed that I knew would make him happy and would give him another perspective and view on the world around him. And one of those vehicles was football.
So, Haley, as we wrap things up here, I mean, what's the answer here? You've been working on this. How do we make youth sports more affordable?
Well, I think that, like Dikembe said, we have to bring more of the community into the conversation, raise the awareness that it is expensive. It's excluding a group of people that should have the opportunity to have just as high quality and has as much fun in youth sports as someone who can pay the $250 for a pair of baseball, football pads. So I think that community conversation, those tough conversations that this is expensive, it's too expensive, how do we keep kids so that they can ultimately have fun? Because that at the end of the day, they don't care about how much it costs. They want to have fun, right, and they want to make friends, and we need to give them that opportunity.
Dikembe, very quickly, last word to you. How do we make youth sports more affordable?
I want to say to Haley that we have come up with a great solution. We create this company. It's called FlipGive. You go to flipgive.com. You create your team. You shop online for any retail store that you want to, and you get close to 25% back, and you can use that 25% back with the $500 cash that we're giving back today. And you can go and support your team.
And what's the website one last time?
FlipGive.com.
Dikembe, great to see you.
Great
Always good to talk to you. Haley, thanks for your time.
I'm glad
Thank
to
you
be in your
me.
Studio. We are not on a plane today.
Exactly. And just ahead on the program, how James Brown's dry cleaning inspired another musical career. Can't wait to hear this. But first, it's not easy building green. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. New research from real estate services giant CBRE finds Atlanta tops the list for eco-friendly office buildings. The study says more than half our office space is certified green through Energy Star, or LEED, and that stands for Leadership in Energy and Design, a green building rating system. Georgia Tech is leading by example, creating what it calls the most environmentally friendly building in the Southeast. It will collect its own water and solar power and use them to satisfy energy needs and irrigate nearby vegetation. The school is slated to break ground on the so-called living building this fall. My colleague Celeste Headlee talked about this in March with Howard Wertheimer, Assistant Vice President for Capital Planning and Space Management at Georgia Tech.
Good morning.
So this is being called a living building. Why is that?
That is the term that was developed by the International Living Future Institute about 10 years ago, and it was defined as being something that is more than just a sustainably designed building, but to be regenerative in its nature. So using the metaphor of a flower as a living organism.
So, I mean, is this more expensive in the long run than just putting up the standard building with concrete bricks and insulation?
Perhaps very minor upfront costs, but long-term operations and maintenance, the answer would be no. So as a university, we own and operate our buildings like many other building owners, and the life cycle analysis would, by reducing our energy costs and water consumption and environmental awareness using the proper materials, that will reduce our costs overall over the term of ownership.
Why is this a priority, though, for Georgia Tech? Because this is not the only building that the school has tried to focus on sustainable building practices. Why?
Correct. So, we've had a long history of designing, constructing, and operating highly sustainable buildings ever since our beginnings, even Tech Tower that was built using red brick, which is indigenous red clay to the state of Georgia. So sustainability has been a part of our DNA since our inception, and this is just the next logical step in developing a building that is highly sustainable so our students, our faculty, our staff, our community, and throughout the state of Georgia and the Southeast can learn from and hopefully find some replicable components that they can apply to their facilities.
How do you know that it is then going to be the most environmentally friendly building in the Southeast?
So to achieve living building certification, unlike other rating systems such as, and there are several of them out there.
Yeah, there's a number.
Correct. That you have to have the building in operation for a minimum of 1 year, and you have to have data related to your energy use, your water use, and you have to submit that data, and then it's analyzed, as opposed to most other rating systems that are really focused on the built environment. So once the building is constructed, you submit, you get points, and you get some type of certification. So this has to be confirmed and verified based on real data of an occupied building.
Okay, so I mentioned that it's going to collect its own water and that it will use solar power. Are there other things that make this building particularly sustainable?
There are, and just to expand upon that, you know, by with the solar power, the building has to be net positive energy. So it has to produce...
It needs to collect more solar power than it uses.
Correct. Not necessarily solar, but a renewable. So we will have geothermal wells in the ground as well that will help with the cooling of the building. So net positive energy, net positive water. So the water that we collect in the building will be used, you know, from rainwater and building condensation will be used within the building, and that footprint of the water has to be less than the water that is collected. So we
the water that is used.
Correct. So we are doing an analysis, and we made the decision that we will use composting toilets in the building, which hasn't been used at Georgia Tech. There are some examples in the city and in Georgia that have composting toilets, so that has a pretty low water footprint.
How do you make these decisions? I mean, a composting toilet is a pretty expensive toilet. That's way more than the $79 variety you buy at Home Depot. And they require a certain amount of upkeep that I imagine is expensive as well. How do you make these calculations on what things to include and what is just not feasible?
So in this case with the composting toilets, we did a very detailed life cycle cost analysis, upfront costs, and actually the upfront costs aren't that significant compared to conventional toilets that you're referring to that has a significant water and piping infrastructure associated with it versus gray water reclamation system that then has to process the water so that it can be used again.
Let's make sure everybody understands what gray water reclamation is. Gray water is water that's usually been used, like to wash your hands or whatever.
Correct.
You would not use that to drink. It's not what we call potable water.
That's correct.
But you can use it to rinse things out or water plants and things like that.
Correct. And at Georgia Tech, we have, you know, over 2.5 million gallons of cisterns. So these are vessels that collect building condensation and stormwater runoff. That water is treated, and in our last several buildings, that water is used for irrigation. It's harvested for irrigation, and it's also used to flush toilets in those buildings. So we're not using potable water to flush toilets.
It seems relatively clear that this is good for the environment, but does it have an educational value?
Very much so. You know, we've had hundreds of students already and faculty already engaged in the living building project. So there, we have had students in design studio. We've had civil engineering students look at aspects of the living building as it relates to their capstone projects. We had a group of students.
What's a capstone project?
So that's their senior thesis project, as their sort of last design project. We have some public policy students who are looking at some policy issues related to the living building. You know, one of the components of a living building are red list free materials. So there are chemicals that are in all sorts of building materials, and the idea is to have manufacturers be more transparent about what is in their product. So we as consumers, just like when we go to the grocery store, we can see the ingredients of a jar of peanut butter. When we look at a chair or a desk or the carpeting, we can see the chemical and material composition, and as consumers, we can decide whether we want to purchase that product or not. And there are about 800 chemicals currently identified on this red list.
So if that's the educational value for it, do you believe that Georgia Tech's building practices, which seem to become more and more green as each building goes up, frankly, do you think they then have an impact on the community around Georgia Tech?
Very much so. You know, we are hoping that, this building will be the first of many that will help transform the building industry in the Southeast by providing cost-effective, replicable components. So it's not to say that others will build the exact same building we will build, but they can learn from our journey, and we're being very transparent. We have a website that tracks all of this information. So we want others to learn, so we're sort of the pebble in the pond of influence throughout our region, throughout the Southeast. And there are other climatic zones around the world that share similar hot, humid environments as Atlanta.
That's Howard Wertheimer, Assistant Vice President for Capital Planning and Space Management at Georgia Tech. This week, we take our show to Macon's historic Douglas Theater. Now, during the 1920s, that theater was an important venue for early African-American films. Over the years, performers like Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington graced the Douglas stage, playing what they called the Chitlin' Circuit. Alan Walden was a music manager who helped start Capricorn Records and who also managed Otis Redding. He says the Douglas played a vital role in Redding's success.
He always knew that he wanted to be a singer. I mean, from a little boy up. And Otis would only hold a job about a week, get his paycheck and change job the next week. But he always was singing. And the Douglas was a big one because it was one of the nicer venues that he played at the time. Not only that, but he rocked them when they were there. They used to call him Rock House Redding.
So on Thursday evening, July 27th, we take our show to the very stage where Otis Redding and many other legends performed. And you can RSVP to join us. Find the event info on our Facebook page. And if you can't make it, listen on Friday morning to hear the recording of that program. And while we're on the subject of celebrating Georgia music, let's add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to pick the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are pretty simple here. All tunes must be written or performed by a Georgian, and artists can't pick one of their own songs. All week, we're featuring songs chosen by musicians performing at Bragg Jam in Macon this weekend. T. Hardy Morris is an Athens-based singer-songwriter, and here are his picks.
Hi, this is T. Hardy Morris, Georgia musician, songwriter. I live in Athens, Georgia, but I grew up in and around Augusta, Georgia. So my first pick is a song by James Brown and the Fabulous Flames called Try Me. The vocal take on this is pretty heart-wrenchingly awesome. Whenever I hear James Brown, I can't help but think about his smile. You would always see him around town pretty often. My first job growing up, I worked at a dry cleaner, and he and his cronies would come in with just mountains of James's wardrobe to be dry cleaning. So it was pretty cool to see him around town a lot growing up. Well, I certainly can't emulate it or sing as well as James, but just listening to someone convey the lyrics as perfectly as he does and all the cracking and, you know, perfect mistakes within his voice just kind of really set the whole thing off. James's voice, he could sing the phone book, but it's very pleading and earnest, and I don't know, he just has that delivery, and this song's a perfect example of that, of his ability to get inside and make any song sound pretty much amazing. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is an artist from Atlanta, Georgia, that I actually only recently found out about a little less than a year ago, named Robert Lester Folsom. I don't know much about him, and there's actually not a lot about him out there, but it's a song called See You Later. That's kind of an exemplary track of everything he does. It's just nice, spacey country strangeness that I guess kind of existed in obscurity for a long time. And then I've been listening to it a lot over the past several months as I was leading up to recording a new record. It's pretty stripped down. It's kind of lo-fi. It sounds like it all might have just been on a four-track. I'm not sure if there was a full band or if he just played everything, but it sounds really raw and haunting, and that track kind of really speaks to, I guess, the mystique of him as an artist, because you don't know much about him and you don't know where he wound up, and so the song See You Later seems kind of fitting for him. I love the sparse drums, kind of Bob Dylan Desire-style drums, but recorded much less professionally. You know, he feels kind of like a strange, lost Graham Parsons or something with much longer hair. When you listen to his songs, some of it seems like it could be cleaned up and could have been done in Nashville or something, but he was probably smoking a bunch of stuff, and so it wound up like that.
That's Athens musician T. Hardy Morris. He will perform at 10 p.m. this Saturday in Macon at Grant's Lounge. And that's our show for today, but we always love to hear from you. Do you have a song you'd put on the Georgia playlist? Tell us about it. Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk to nominate a tune. You can find the entire Georgia playlist series along with all of the great music segments we've done here at gpbnews.org. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.